Folks, welcome to the Caris Molecular Minute Podcast. This is your host, Shadi Nabhan. I'm the chairman of the Caris Precision Oncology Alliance, our large collaborative research network composed of many academic institutions and healthcare systems, as well as research consortia and cooperative groups. All of us are collaborating together on big data research, artificial intelligence, biomarker research, molecular profiling, with the ultimate goal of improving the outcomes of all patients affected with cancer. Today's podcast addresses something that is very important, which is equity in clinical trials. We all want patients to have better access to clinical trials. We all know that very few patients are enrolled on clinical trials in the United States of America. The recent stats that I found was less than 10% of adult patients with cancer are enrolled on clinical trials. And we all know that more patients enrolled on clinical trials is going to allow better progress, better access to innovative therapies, and hopefully better outcomes. Having said that, not all patients have the ability to get on clinical trials for a variety of reasons. The passionate, the amazing Dr. Ishwarya Subbiah at the Sarah Cannon Research Institute has a different idea, and she believes that we can make significant progress. She believes that we can actually improve the access to clinical trials, and we can hopefully mitigate the disparities in clinical trials and work together towards equality and equity in being able to access these studies. Dr. Ishwarya Subbiah has been recently recruited to the Sarah Cannon Research Institute, and in her new role, which she will describe to you on this podcast, she's leading the efforts to improving the equity of clinical trials. But her vision of that is that this is really beyond underrepresented minorities only, and it's rather that whoever you are, you may be in an area that you just don't have access to trials, how can we work to give you that access no matter who you are? You are going to be inspired by listening to this great interview with the amazing Dr. Ishwarya Subbiah. And without further ado, the one and only Dr. Ishwarya Subbiah from the Sarah Cannon Research Institute on the Caris Molecular Minute Podcast. Tell us a little bit about you for those who are listening to this podcast who don't know who you are.
Of course. And Happy New Year, everybody. It will be 2024 when you hear this. And so Ishwarya Subbiah, I'm a medical oncologist and a palliative care physician, and I joined Sarah Cannon over the summer of 2023, so I guess it'll be last year, as the executive director for cancer care equity and professional well-being. And so in this role, my work is really centered on those system-level changes. What are those upstream steps that we can take to the design and implementation of a cancer clinical trial to proactively mitigate or eliminate the barriers that we know from those retrospective studies to affect who gets on a study, who gets even offered a study, and who ends up enrolling and going through to completion. And so in this role, it was really taking some of that pressure and onus off of individual frontline clinicians and really look at, on a system level, how can we make the clinical trial experience as streamlined as possible in a proactive way with access in mind. And so that's my role here.
And we're going to dig a little bit into this, but before we get into that, Ishwarya, a little bit about your background. At Sarah Cannon, they stole you from MD Anderson, where you were there for quite a bit, no?
Quite a bit of time. I was in Houston for 15 years, and you only would know that after you look at the sheer amount of stuff that was in our house. So it was a time capsule. Each of our cabinets was a time capsule of content we've accumulated. But Houston was home for 15 years, and a bulk of that time was spent at MD Anderson, both training and joining the faculty. And in that mid-career stage, when I made the decision to
Well,
move.
Sarah Cannon is lucky to have you, and hopefully this is an amazing synergy between what you're looking for and what they're looking for. What got you into palliative care or interest in doing some palliative care as you were going through your career decisions?
My very first training was in early phase drug development. I spent a year in a phase one fellowship at MD Anderson, right before my medical oncology fellowship. And my goal all along was to be in drug development. What I didn't expect, which was a delightful surprise, was as I went through my phase one training, I found myself gravitating towards the people on the clinical trial, the patients on the clinical trial, characteristics about them, what brought them to the study, how did they do on the study. My very first project at Anderson was about older adult participation on phase one clinical trials. That was around the time when we were seeing early phase studies with such active compounds where they were going directly to FDA for an indication based on phase one and the expansion cohorts. And so suddenly what you have is a product, a treatment for cancer that is out in the general community ready for use without necessarily, you know, years worth of data on how people do on those studies. So that clinical decision making suddenly rests with data that's available up to that point in early phase studies. And so in that context, older adults, 65 and above, they represent a bulk of both cancer incidence and prevalence. And so it was seeing how well represented were they on these studies that are being taken for approval. And that put me on this road to better understand the people who are on the studies. And so the focus on symptom management was a natural evolution, because so much of the decision making about a clinical trial versus not, or even a standard of care treatment versus no additional treatment, centers on toxicity, right? How am I going to do on it? How is my quality of life going to be? What can I expect? And so that naturally brought me to subspecialty training within palliative care, which as a field is symptom management across the entire illness continuum and trajectory. And so that's how I found myself at this intersection of drug development, medical oncology, and supportive and palliative care.
And it's amazing because there's a lot of data out there about the importance of integrating palliative care into oncology care. And it's kind of, sometimes I feel it's an oxymoron, because most oncologists feel, well, I can really handle all of these things. And maybe we can to an extent, but I do think that it's like calling any consult. You call the cardiologist, you call the nephrologist. There's always this hesitancy about calling palliative care, but that's for a different podcast. I think we know the inherent stigma behind this, right? But I really want to shift back to this clinical trial issue, because a lot of people, I have to tell you, there's this notion. Anytime you tell someone, I want to work on increasing enrollment of patients in clinical trials, you know what they tell you? Like, a lot of people have tried before you. Good luck with that. I want to increase more people who usually don't get enrolled in clinical trials. Well, good luck with that. So there's this skepticism about, is this really going to work? Now, I'm very optimistic after I learned about your role, because I know who you are and I know your passion and I know what you're capable of. But let us transmit that optimism to listeners of this podcast. Where do you start? What are you going to do? How do you build a roadmap? I know that's a lot of questions in one, and we can really segment it and dissect it. So let's start by, where do you start? Give us the problem, I guess. Let's share the problem, And then let's start looking at solutions one after the other.
So equity and access in clinical trials and cancer care disparities, these are societal issues that are right up there with climate change and world peace when it comes to mountains that you would want to, mountains that seem like complex problems requiring solutions. The fact is, it's the, when we look at cancer outcomes disparities and specifically about clinical trial access and participation, the very first steps center on getting alignment on the what and the why. And so the what is that we are seeing different outcomes in the real world with the same treatment because by subgroups, subpopulations. We are seeing communities experience different outcomes with the cancer care in its current state by virtue of them belonging to that community. What that also means is that with the advances we've made in cancer, we are leaving people behind. We are leaving communities behind. That's confirmed through years and years of data on different outcomes by rurality, by where you live, by how much education you have, by your race, ethnicity. And so the second part is level setting understanding on what equity truly means in the context of a clinical trial. Equity, for better or worse, is a word that's taken on so much of a meaning in a social sense. But the fact is, when we're talking about equity in the context of clinical trials, we're talking about access. We're talking about every person having the opportunity to consider a clinical trial, every person with cancer having the opportunity to consider clinical trials as part of their next step in their cancer care. And us as stakeholders within oncology, making sure that the ecosystem and the environment are there to where any individual with cancer can consider a trial and decide for it or against it on their own, on their own accord. This also means recognizing that communities that experience a disparate outcome, they are as diverse as you can think of. When you hear equitable participation on studies, someone may think of, you know, race, ethnicity, and that is a really important part. We're talking about older adults, seniors who are 65 and above. We're talking about adolescent young adults. We're talking about veterans. We're talking about people who live in rural America. We're talking about people with disabilities, physical, emotional, those that are perceptible and those that are not, comorbidities. And so what you start to realize is by the time you see that list of communities known to have disparate outcomes, either you yourself fit into one of those categories or the people you care about do.
And it's like the idea that, you know, anytime you have people talking about disparities in clinical trials, oftentimes the focus is only on one aspect, which is underrepresented minorities. And that's obviously an aspect that, you know, we don't want to really ignore, but what I'm hearing from you is that there is really more to it beyond race and ethnicity and other things that represents these disparities.
Exactly. There are shared upstream factors that translate to lower enrollment of underrepresented communities. The underrepresentation, when you do the root cause across different groups with the disparate outcomes, there are certain barriers that are unique to those groups, but then there's a collection of barriers that are shared across the groups.
So the problem is well outlined, and I think we can all relate to it. I think we'd like to see solutions, and no one will say that these solutions will need to happen overnight. But so how do you build a roadmap to overcome these issues?
The very first step, so after we level set the what and the why, we go into the how, right? We see a list of drivers of disparities: economics, geography, education, food security, home security, elements of that are so complex in and of itself. But what I always tell my team and our collaborators as part of that recalibration is look, we are not here for that person who didn't finish high school, and that's a established driver behind disparities. We're not here to start the Sarah Cannon Research Institute high school so that people can get their degree. It's more about what about that element of their experience is affecting their decision-making. Their decision-making as it pertains to healthcare. What about not finishing high school? What about being in a rural area is driving their decision-making about getting cancer care, period, and more specifically about clinical trial participation? Because that's where we as the oncology community at large can intervene to see what element of that factor is modifiable. Many of the approaches that are thrown around in discussions are very reasonable in this context, right? It's minimizing the number of visits, doing labs closer to home, or having virtual visits, or some type of these, just to give a few examples of accommodations. Where I find my optimism in this work, optimism enough to uproot from a place I was very, very comfortable in to take this chance, is that you're in an organization where you're placed in an org chart to be able to make things happen. You're empowered as a leader to bring together people who are ready to find solutions. And you also are in a place where you see that opportunity for end-to-end equity support, meaning from idea generation, you have the opportunity to influence how that concept is developed in those advisory boards, at those tables, to the design of the protocol itself, through to the pre-activation stage, whether it's site feasibility, whether it's the strategies to promote recruitment and retention. And then you have the opportunity to continue support through the life cycle of that study in its implementation stage. This is part of how we look at equity as a dynamic. Access and equity is a dynamic entity. It's not a one-time retrospective review of everyone who's enrolled on a trial.
I like what you mentioned, that sometimes the ecosystem where you are at does affect your decision making. So it's not, you know, and we have to look at that to try to actually overcome some of it. I understand that piece, but what I don't know how you can get around it. I mean, if I live in a rural area, I can't really drive 100 miles to go to a site where there's a clinical trial. And it is very possible that the closest oncology office that I have in town may not have the infrastructure. I mean, they just don't have clinical trials. So some of it may not be me as an individual. It could be the logistics and things of that nature. And I mean, I don't think, maybe you can, but I would assume you can't really bring the infrastructure to every single office in every rural area. How do you get around that as an example?
This is where there truly needs to be a core group of people who get around a table and talk through what true innovation in the clinical trial implementation stage looks like. one of the active areas of our work is understanding what elements of trial implementation actually need site level action versus a more being able to transfer that task load more centrally. You can only do exercises like that if you have key leaders within, from the practice setting, from the research and clinical operations setting, as well as the industry partner at that table. And so for that person who's in a rural area, the barriers may truly be insurmountable for them, for an individual patient. But what we're talking about on a system level is for that clinic that's close to that rural area, or for that clinic that may never have had a clinical trial open there, what are the elements of a research infrastructure that actually need to be there? Not how it's been done in the past. What are the actual elements that go with implementing that study, need an on-site presence, need physical hands on the patient, versus functionalities that may have historically been on-site physical, but don't actually need to be by both our standards of medical practice, but also from the regulatory authorities?
So what you're suggesting is potentially for a particular study, we probably usually ask for so many things to be required to execute on this trial, and we're probably overcomplicating things. Maybe we could simplify it a little bit more, where it become more available at a smaller office in a rural area where patients in Middle America are able to be enrolled on it.
This is what we call, you know, aggressive simplification. But it's getting back to the core of clinical research. It's getting back to the, it's bringing that joy of research back to both the patients who participate in it, the caregivers who are along for the ride, and the clinical and the research teams who have to execute that study.
Would the N of one or the right-in-time platform, is that something that might actually help in situations where there's usually not a lot of resources? You know, I mean, like these where you just enroll the patient only at the time of identifying the molecular abnormality or the inclusion-exclusion criteria?
Absolutely. That's an element. The just-in-time model of site activation is an element of innovation that is part of what drew me to Sarah Cannon. And this is, you know, how can we, instead of the norm paradigm is investing upfront in a quote-unquote what's considered to be a robust infrastructure. But what we recognize is that robustness doesn't always correlate with efficiency, ROI, or that gold standard, which is getting people access to the trials they need. And so it's not about more FTEs. It's how do you make bandwidth as dynamic as the clinical trial reality we're in, to where you allocate it where it's needed, when it's needed, and then you move it on.
And then I like the fact that you're talking about having the industry partners. How do we make industry partners simplify a little bit of the inclusion-exclusion criteria, where you don't need to do 700 biopsies after each dose and things of that nature, where, you know what I mean? I mean, some of these trials are just a little bit too much for a lot of folks. And I presume that this factors into your path into improving the access to clinical trials.
So the inclusion-exclusion criteria is one place where the more upstream we can get, the better. The upstream in the design of that study. So in that advisory board meeting, in those design sessions where the study is put together, we need to stop it before it starts. Do we really need a normal albumin? Is that going to make a difference? Do we really need a creatinine clearance of X when this drug really doesn't care whether there's a kidney or not, because it has nothing to do with its metabolism has nothing to do with renal function? But those are elements that are so much easier to discuss if we do it at the design phase upstream. once that protocol goes through its reviews and gets disseminated to the sites, we still use that opportunity to alert the sponsors if there are criteria that we can see will impact patient access, and we don't see ready evidence that it impacts a safety or a clinical outcome. We still do our due diligence and raise it up to the sponsors, but you see how much harder it is when it's reactive equity versus what our organizational pillar is, which is proactive equity and access.
So my last question to you is, whenever you go into a project or a path, you have to have certain metrics that's going to assess whether you have been successful or not. I know your passion, and I'm sure you're going to be successful, but how are you going to measure that? Because if, let's say, whatever you're trying to do is proven not as easy, you may have to pivot and try to change your strategy because you want to achieve success. What are the metrics of success that you are monitoring over the next 12 to 18 months to determine whether what you are doing is going as you expect or you need to pivot and make some changes?
You know, if we were having this conversation in my office, I would show you what I have framed on by my desk. And it's really a quote, I think it was from an IBM scientist, that says, "In God we trust, all others must bring data." So the number one pillar of our program is check your perceptions at the door. Check your assumptions, what your expert opinion at the door. It's an important part of the discussion, but the foundation of our equity work will be data, data-driven equity. And so when we look at metrics of success, it's the starting point and every incremental win towards that gold standard of representative enrollment. Number of studies offered, number of patients screened for a study, number of patients who even are offered studies, the measure of clinical trial awareness among the people who walk through the doors. So there's a portfolio of our work in our cancer care equity team that's centered on individual studies and strategic partnerships. There's an entire portfolio of work that's centered on the barrier, the community that we know has certain unique needs, not those shared needs, but those unique needs. So by having this diverse portfolio of work, we're not actually leaving any gaps. The goal is not to leave gaps. And this has been one of the greatest pitfalls of so many great intentions of the people, of those of us in oncology, as individuals. I think we all have alignment that access to clinical trials is important. Having that decision to participate should be the patients, not so much the systems or that they're never offered. So we have alignment on that. Where you see that exasperation is, it's hard to do that as an individual, but you can actually mobilize a system. You can mobilize a health system and a research organization towards that goal. And so data-driven equity is the foundation of our work.
Well, Ishwarya, I wish you all the luck. We are going to have you back in 12 months. I'm going to give you 12 months to get some metrics so you can share with us before and after. But I have no doubt that you're going to make a huge impact in your endeavor. And we're all cheering for you. And I really appreciate you spending some time with me on the Caris Molecular Minute podcast.
Well, I appreciate you having me here. This is such a collaborative area of work, and we have so many great partners across the country and world that we're just thrilled to be working with.
Thank you so much, Ishwarya. Dr. Subbiah on the Caris Molecular Minute podcast. Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Caris Molecular Minute podcast. I appreciate your support. I appreciate you being an avid listener to this podcast. Thank you to my guest, Dr. Ishwarya Subbiah, for being on the Caris Molecular Minute podcast. Until next time, take care.